Now this morning, I want to introduce to you a friend, Brother Dan Johnson. He comes to us this morning from Memphis, Tennessee. However, don't let him fool you. He grew up in North Dakota. I grew up in South Dakota. North Dakota got the oil. We got Mount Rushmore. I think you got the better deal up there. All right. And God has used him as a pastor. God has used him as an evangelist, camp speaker, and an author. And this morning, he has a message that I believe is for us for today. I want you to welcome Brother Dan Johnson. Make him for a worldly welcome. Will you do that? To Oak Creek Assembly of God this morning. Brother Dan, you're amongst friends. Excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. I love you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I have decided that if I were a member of this church, I would pray that Pastor and Mrs. Jerry Brooks would stay here until Jesus comes. And you may want them to stay longer, but they've got to go. I've known and loved Jerry Brooks and Sherry for 40 years and greatly admire the gifts God has given him. He has the shepherd's heart of a pastor, and that's a treasure. And with this magnificent staff, I met Dan Wooten's cousin. I had dinner with him the other night down in Memphis, and he said, "Look up my cousin, and I'm going to go back with a good report." And these wonderful singers and the band is all, it was beautiful. Thank you for the opportunity being with you today. Would you take your Bibles and turn to the 11th Psalm. The 11th Psalm. This is a psalm for these times. The 11th Psalm. Let me read just a few of the verses. In the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For look, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but the wicked and the one who loves violence, his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain coals, fire and brimstone and a burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. His countenance beholds the upright. If the foundations are destroyed, verse 3, what can the righteous do? Well, for starters, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let me begin with a story. It was toward dusk on November 18, 1863, when Abraham Lincoln rode into Gettysburg. From the railroad station, he walked two blocks to the home of David Wills, a local attorney, where in a small upstairs room, he would prepare remarks to be delivered the following day at the dedication of the Gettysburg National Cemetery. It's a simple room. If you're a tourist, you may have been there, with a bed, a water basin, a pitcher, a mirror, some towels. And there on the bed lay the president's white gloves and his black stovepipe hat. Can you picture it? The tall, thin man with a sad face sitting at the small round table, white collarless shirt, black trousers, white suspenders, black boots. When a crowd gathered on the street, The president walked to the window, opened it, and briefly greeted the people before returning to the small round table where he wrote on a plain piece of white paper. In the morning, he went downstairs, mounted a black steed, and followed the Marine band and led the throng of 10 to 15,000 people several blocks to the cemetery, the scene of the important event today. Now, the major speaker of the day was not the president, but Mr. Edward Everett, noted for his brilliant oratory, former governor of Massachusetts, now president of Harvard. Following a number by the Marine Band, Mr. Edward Everett spoke eloquently for 2 hours. 2 hours. And then, following a hymn, the tall, thin man with a sad face strode to the brow of the hill, paused for a moment, scanning that sea of faces and the fields beyond where Union and Confederate soldiers lay buried. It was an awful war. As you remember, some 620,000 Union and Confederate soldiers had died in that war. 50,000 casualties in the Battle of Gettysburg alone. And now, in a voice rather high-pitched and almost shrill, the president began, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Now we stop right there, because in that sentence is a question. Can such a nation endure? And the answer is never settled. It's not fixed, as freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. If you uncouple one link, the strongest chain is broken. So can such a nation endure? It remains to be seen. Russell Kirk once said, a people uninterested in their history may cease to have a history or to remain a nation. Who are we? Where did we come from? This church has a history. Edmund Burke long ago warned that the desecration of the past is the first step in the destruction of the present. If we're going to find an answer to the question, can such a nation endure? Can a church like this go on from one generation to another? We must settle in our minds who we are, where we came from, what is our foundation. Totalitarianism cannot exist until you remove the past or muddy it, you see. The revisionists are always busy trying to revise history, and the tragedy of our time is that we've raised a generation almost ignorant of who we are. So history is important. The moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all thy piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. I was in Minot, North Dakota, about 3 weeks ago, checked into the hotel, and a very pleasant girl at the desk there, at the counter, 26 years old, very pleasant. I said, well, what brought you to Minot? She said, we came for work because of the oil business up there. I said, where did you come from? She said, I came from California. Where in California? I asked. Modesto. Oh, and then I remembered that I had recently spoken in a church in Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, which is a small town near Modesto. And I met there the brother of Cliff Barrows, Billy Graham's song leader, who was raised in Ceres. And I was going to tell this girl about my visit to her hometown. But first I asked, now, you know who Billy Graham is? No. Name doesn't ring a bell. Do you know, have you ever heard of Bev Shea, who just died at the age of 104? No, never. And I stood there for a moment. I didn't say anything, but I was stunned. I was stunned. And then I remembered reading in the Wall Street Journal a little while the report results of a Pew Research survey that showed that 47% of American youth have no memory of Billy Graham. Now, I understand. It's not a moral issue. I understand that. We can't remember everything. I know that one generation comes and it goes, and what's important to this generation is not important to the next. I understand that. And there arose a king in Egypt which knew not Joseph. But the truth is, remains, that for much of the last 75 years, Billy Graham's name has been in the newspapers from time to time. You understand what I'm saying? So it's not a moral issue. But then the question in my mind was, what else have we forgotten? What else have we forgotten? Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, to destroy a people, you must sever their roots. Sever their roots. I was talking to your pastor about his hometown, Sisseton, South Dakota. His mother, who turns 100 next week, gave birth to 10 sons and one daughter. Can you imagine? With some of the sons like your pastor. That's his heritage. That's his roots. And it was Hannah Arendt who said, the rootless are always violent. So what if the foundations are destroyed? Dr. Os Guinness said, we are witnessing the destruction of external standards of conduct and the dissolution of internal foundations of identity. You see? I want to show you very quickly. The game is canceled. I want to show you very quickly I will pay for that. It hasn't been. I want to show you very quickly what happens when the foundation is removed. When you take the sledgehammer of unbelief, or the chisel, or the jackhammer, and break that foundation. I want to show you what happens. First of all, there are no moorings. There's no anchor. There's no foundation. The truth disappears. There's no truth. There's no truth. I personally think one of the great tragedies of my time is the fact that many in this generation have rejected the very concept of truth. And the problem with that, to my mind, going beyond the philosophical aspect of it, is that it all comes back to Jesus, who said, I am the truth. There is such a thing as truth. I don't mean to belabor this, and I don't mean to talk down to anybody, but I'm in touch with some of these folks, and I happen to know that across the spectrum, many of our colleges and universities, not all of them, don't be angry with me. The idea that there is something to put your feet on, There is something you can believe, sink your teeth into. The former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, recently died. Speaking to a group of students in Minneapolis some time ago, said, "We have left you with no single belief you could put your finger on." That's unfair to these youngsters. No wonder the millennials are upset. Because we've left them with no single belief they could put your finger on. You see that? And they tell us that truth is relative. Really? That means that the War of 1812 was fought in 1712. That means that water freezes at 50 degrees rather than 32. That means that Milwaukee lies on the east coast south of Chicago. There is no mathematical truth, no historical truth, no geographical truth. There's no truth. And the theologian R.C. Sproul said, "The philosophy that denies the possibility of truth is a philosophy that denies its own truth claim." So if you tell me there is no truth, then I say I'm not going to believe you because you don't believe in truth. And then there are no beacons of the past. There's no common orientation. There are no grid of references. There are no fences. There are no boundaries. And so the youngster leaves the frat house and goes to the party on Friday night or Saturday night. And because doubt has been sown in the classroom, there is indiscretion now, and he has nothing to lean on. Do you understand what I'm saying? This is a tragedy of our time. I mentioned in the early service, before he became president, Barack Obama wrote a book in 2006 entitled The Audacity of Hope, in which he makes this strange statement. He said, "Implicit in the Constitution's structure is a rejection of absolute truth. The infallibility of any idea, ideology, ism, theology, the tyrannical consistency of any single unalterable truth that might lock future generations in a particular course of action." Well, you look at that. If truth is a tyrannical consistency, if there is no truth, no wonder the politician and the professor and maybe the preacher and maybe your spouse can look you in the eye and tell you something they know to be untrue, because there is no truth. 25 years ago, Dr. Carl F.H. Henry said, "This generation is lost to the truth of God, to the truth of divine revelation, to the content of his will, to the power of redemption, to the authority of his word." That's a tragedy to me. And he said, "For this loss, it is paying dearly in a swift relapse to paganism." He said, the savages, you can hear them rumbling and rustling in the temple of our times. Because there's no truth. And consequently, second thing is that the culture unravels. It unravels. Like, have you ever seen a kid get a hold of a thread in a sweater? And he pulls that, and it just begins to unravel. That's what's happening in our culture today. It's just unraveling. Out of Sochi, Winter Olympics a few months ago, NBC had this headline: "Alternate lifestyle wins the gold." Well, I thought that's interesting. Alternate lifestyle wins the gold. And it was the story of David Weiss, 23, who had won the Olympic gold in freestyle skating, whatever that is. And the alternate part was, the alternative lifestyle was, that he is married, has a 2-year-old child, and wants to be a pastor. And in this generation, that makes him weird. Do you understand what I'm saying? We are witnessing the moral inversion in which the old words take on new meanings. Transvaluation of values, Nietzsche. When the old sins take on new values, new virtues, and the old virtues take on new sins, and everything is on its head. It's crazy. And see, I'm just a country boy, and I'm not too bright, but I'm still trying to figure out, maybe somebody here can help me, how something was wrong 100 years ago, 50 years ago, 25 years ago, 2 years ago. And all of a sudden, it's right. And if you don't go along with the switch, you're on the wrong side of history. And who wants to be on the wrong side of history? So when truth is gone, there's no authoritative word of God. There's nothing certain. Can such a nation endure? Can a church endure? Can a family withstand the onslaught from a secular society and culture when you just rip the bottom out from things? It's all gone. Patrick Buchanan put it like this. He said, "We have thrown overboard the moral compass by which the Republic steered for 200 years. Now it sails by dead reckoning." Who can argue with that? We are staring into the abyss of comprehensive moral corruption. Who can deny it? And it's my children and my grandchildren who are caught up in this thing. And that's why I do what you parents do. I get on my knees and I pray for them. Every day I pray for them. Every day I pray for them. Because if there is no truth, there is no way for them to make sound decisions. Unless they're going to just make it up out of whole cloth. And that spells disaster. Because when the culture unravels, the third step is the loss of freedom. As a nation, we will be governed by God or ruled by tyrants. It can't be any other way. I read just the other day that this week in Germany, they have removed the crosses, the pulpits, and the altars from some of their churches because they didn't want to offend anybody. And I thought when I saw that, how well did it work the last time the Germans removed the cross from their schools and their churches? And the Holocaust was just a matter of time. And to illustrate this, go to Saudi Arabia. You can fly from Mitchell Field here. Go to Saudi Arabia. And you may lose your head if they know you have a cross in your position. People are beheaded because they have a cross. See, when the crosses are gone, when the word of God is disdained and disavowed, when we decide that Jesus is not the singular, transcendent truth, then we're in big trouble. Thomas Jefferson said it like this: "God who gave us life gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be secure when we have removed a conviction that these liberties are the gift of God?" No wonder he said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." Depends on what you want, what kind of a country you want, what kind of a church do you want, what kind of families do we want to raise. No wonder crime is spiking. And you get out of your car in Memphis, where I live, and you look both ways before you dash into the building where you're headed. Why? Someone described our plight like this: referring to the violence in too many of our cities. Our playgrounds have become battlegrounds. Our streets have become cemeteries. Our schools have become places to mourn the ones we've lost. That's not the way it should be, but that's the way it is. When we reject truth, it is unavoidable, the unraveling of the culture. And then the loss of freedom. You can't pray over here. And down in Oklahoma, they removed the Ten Commandments from the state house, Capitol, and they did it at night so nobody would see or protest. But aren't you happy that they took the Ten Commandments to a museum? The only problem with that is that God doesn't belong in a museum. And we are obsessed. We are offended. We are offended to teach our children, thou shalt not kill. That is somehow offensive. And so what happens? Our children kill. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Go through all of them. And so, see, we've got to decide what kind of a foundation we're going to have. One more thing. When truth disappears and the culture unravels and we lose our freedoms, we also lose our soul. What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? Lose your soul. Stephen Hawking, one of the greatest scientists of our time, stricken with, I think, ALS when he was a child. He shouldn't have lived another half dozen years. He's recently celebrated his 70th birthday. You've seen a picture of him sitting in his chair. He can hardly move a muscle. They rigged up some kind of a contraption. He can do something and somehow speak through that thing. He wrote a book read by 10 million people. It takes him 10 minutes to form a word. Stephen Hawking. Brilliant. But there's no room for God in his thinking. And he said, we are such insignificant creatures on a minor planet of a very average star at the outside suburbs of one of 100,000 million galaxies. So it is hard to believe in a God that would care for us or even notice our existence. But then he added, but what breathed fire into the equations? It's like Jean-Paul Sartre said, that God does not exist, I cannot forget, but that my whole being cries out for God, I cannot deny. See, God is gone now. Now we have the quote-unquote new atheists, and God is just absent. And the soul is lost. I was in New York some time ago, and I learned that Larry King was to autograph his new book. I had the time. I was nearby. Went to the Crown Books on DuPont Circle, and I was in line with a book. And as he inscribed a note to my son, I asked Larry King, who has interviewed thousands of people, I said, sir, if you could ask God one question, what would it be? And without looking up, without hesitating, he replied, did you have a son? Because if God had a son, it would change everything. Now, Larry King, unfortunately, doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe there is a God. But in the back of his mind, he wonders, what if God had a son? You see? So how do we live in a time like this, in a world that has its problems? A wonderful place to live. I'm not a downer. I'm a sweet guy, and I'm happy today, but we live in troubled times. We live in troubled times. And how do we deal with these things? Well, to the church, I would say this. Make prayer your business. Thing I remember about my last visit here a few years ago was the way you tarried at the altar area on Sunday night service. That's your strength. That's your strength. More marriages are healed, more problems are solved at the prayer meeting than in the counseling room. No question about it. Make prayer your business. Make the Bible your book. Make your priority and your passion, the evangelization of the lost and your missions. And congratulations on what you're doing here in this church. And I think of the dozens of people who have gone from this church all over the world preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I say to parents, how do we live in a time like this? Well, by a precept and example, teach your children there is such a thing as truth. Teach them that it is not wrong to be different. Teach them that if they want to do what is right, it will probably mean that at one time or another, they will stand on the outside of some circles. And there may not be any quote-unquote truth, but all of us in this room want our neurosurgeon, our airline pilot, and bank president to believe in truth. And I say to the millennials, God love you, sweet people, living in an interesting and challenging time, don't sell out cheap. Don't be ashamed of Jesus. Don't be embarrassed to name his name. Don't do it. Don't barter your soul for a mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and a dance, and a song. Nothing you will ever do, ever, can be good if it is not ultimately good for eternity. And to all of us in this great church, with our pastor, the day is far spent, the night is at hand, our age is but the falling of a leaf, a dropping tear. Life is brief and sin is here. Rise up, O men of God, women of God, have done with lesser things. Give heart and mind and soul and strength unto the King of Kings. I close with a little story. The Asiatic monk spent his years in reflection and prayer, meditation. And one day, it seemed to those with him, it was almost an impulse, although he said that God was leading him. Telemachus, it's not a Norwegian name, packed up everything he possessed, put it on his back, and he took the long journey from Asia to Rome. It took him days. And he arrived in Rome following the great victory over the Goths, and the people were in a celebratory mood. And he followed the crowds, vast crowds, up those winding streets, and they went to the Colosseum. And the little monk from Asia followed them, and he went into the Colosseum, and he went way up those tiers and way up on top, and he looked down there at those gladiators who killed each other just for fun, and listened to the snarl of wild animals in their cages waiting to be released and go out and perhaps kill a Christian. And he took it all in, and suddenly he couldn't help himself. He cried, "In the name of Christ, forbear." And then he came down those stairs and went right down to the floor of the arena. They thought it was entertainment. He looked weird in his monkish habit, running back and forth between the gladiators. They thought it was a part of the program until he began to obstruct the vision of the people watching the gladiators fight. And he said, "In the name of Christ, Forbear. And then the crowd grew angry and they began to cry, run him through, run him through. And a gladiator took his sword and began to slash and cut that little monk. And before he fell, he cried one more time, in the name of Christ, forbear, stop this madness. And fell dead on the floor, now red with his own blood. An eerie silence fell over the Colosseum. And way up there, a man got up and he came down the stairs and slipped out a door. And over here, a man got up and he came way down and slipped out. And then others got up and removed. And now dozens and then hundreds got up and moved until the Colosseum, the great Roman Colosseum, was empty. There were other forces at work in Rome at that time. But that was the last gladiatorial fight in the Roman arena. No one ever died in the arena again because of one man. One man. Oak Creek Assembly of God. One man, you. One woman, you. Make a difference. Make a difference. In the name of Christ, make a difference. God bless you.